Free lunch. It's up and running this summer break, even though school is out. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this morning, we've got a look at the massive citywide effort to make sure school kids don't go hungry this summer. You can join us now. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the forgotten parts of our First Coast. We speak with the author of Abandoned Jacksonville. Plus, a look at the new production from artist and playwright Ebony Payne English on stage right here this month at our WJCT studios. All of that ahead this hour, but first this morning, hunger in our area. For thousands of local children, free school lunch is the only meal of the day they can actually count on. And with schools now out for the summer, a great program is up and running to make sure children get something good and healthy to eat. The Free Summer Lunch Program kicked off this week at 12 branches of the Jacksonville Public Library. All kids up to the age of 18 can get a free meal from now until August 2nd at participating branches. At the same time, local food pantries are doing their part to make sure families don't go hungry this summer, particularly children. Here with more, we welcome Chris Boven with the Jacksonville Public Library. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Michael Neff, Chief Operating Officer for Feeding Northeast Florida.
Good morning.
Gentlemen, good to have you both. And as we talk about this issue, we want your calls. Were you aware that more than half of the kids in Duval County schools are on free or reduced lunch? That's many thousands of children. And so when school is out, if it weren't for these efforts, these children would have nothing healthy to eat most of the summer. This is a serious issue, hunger and food insecurity in our area. And we want your thoughts and comments at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org and tweets to at Melissa in Jax. Our Facebook page is open too. Chris Boven, let's begin with you. This is a program being run through the Jacksonville Public Library branches. Free summer lunch for any child that needs it. Tell us about it.
Sure. No, thanks, Melissa. The program is, it's at 12 different branches. It's provided, the program comes down through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and it's the Kids Hope Alliance that actually funds getting all of these sites together, and they do all the volunteering. And it's wonderful that we have the opportunity to do this at 12 libraries around the city where kids are in need. And we all know that kids they have a lot harder time if they're not getting regular lunches. So it's really great that we can do this at the libraries, and it dovetails very well with our summer programs because not only are we giving kids helping to facilitate these lunches for kids, but then it also gives us an opportunity to get them interested in reading. And we have a lot of really fun programs and really great things going on. So it's mm-hmm. It's a really great chance for us to connect with the community and help make a difference to these kids.
Now, this is called Summer Break Spot.
Right.
And so you can go to the website summerbreakspot.org to see where the nearest location is
yep.
for your child.
Right. So Summer Break Spot is a great place to go. There is a map that the USDA provides, and it will find your location, and it'll tell you all the different locations right around you. So there's churches, community centers, schools that will provide these lunches, and of course, you know, many, many of our libraries.
And I think it might be hard for people to get their minds around the idea that there are so many thousands of kids in this city that depend on free breakfast and lunch through the Duval County Public Schools during the
right.
school year. And many of them go home with a backpack on the weekends
right.
with more food to get them through the weekend. Once school gets out for the summer, they're out of luck
yeah.
unless it were for programs like this, because their parents are in poverty and they don't have enough money for food.
Yeah, they just don't have enough to make this connection for the kids and to fill this gap. So it's one of these great opportunities to kind of get and work with kids and make sure that they have this great nutritious lunch that keeps them going through the day when they don't have it available.
And we're talking about hunger and food insecurity on the First Coast. This summer, kids in particular are at risk. We are trying to get the word out about free lunch for children all through the summer and other efforts to feed families. What are your thoughts about this? It's 549-2937. Michael Neff with Feeding Northeast Florida. Your organization serves more than 250,000 people, not just in Jacksonville, but across 8 North Florida counties. And the need is great. I think people just don't realize how great the need is and how big your efforts are. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, just to go into detail, and thank you, Melissa, for having me here this morning, is about 1 in 5 children in our area are food insecure. That means they don't know where their next meal is going to come from. So that's well over 70,000 kids. Just this summer alone, we'll serve about 3 million meals to address food insecurity in the area, and that is just a fraction of it. So while summer is this really exciting time for kids, so this is where you have that experience of being out of school, being with friends, that is just one of the experiences. Another experience is the stress of losing that meal that's regular, not knowing where that next meal is going to come from, because during the school year, we have a program called the Backpack Program. We do over 4,000 of those every month. And that helps the meal gap of the weekend. And now it's not just the weekend. It's the entire summer. It's just a full meal gap that we have to address. And I'm excited about this program at the library because this is a program that's exciting because you're going to bring in other programs, other experiences to children. Because I always look for that in our programs is what are you going to connect them to? So we're connecting them with several key agencies right now. We work with Lutheran Social Services, UCOM, Salzbacher, and a bunch of organizations that are going to be feeding families as well as the kids and as well as connecting them to other things they need to fight that cycle of poverty.
Because if children don't have enough to eat, it literally stunts their physical development and their brain development.
Yes.
It's a serious public health issue.
It's a public health issue. It's a mental health issue. It addresses a number of things where that anxiety of not knowing where your next meal comes from affects the whole family.
And, you know, let's also talk about the fact that children who need this, families don't have to present any documentation. They don't have to present income eligibility requirements. They just have to show up. It's a matter of getting the word out in the short term, isn't it?
Yeah, all kids 18 age and under, just come on in, go to one of these sites, come to one of the libraries and show up and you will get a great nutritious lunch. It's a really great program and no question to ask.
Now, for people listening that might not have internet access, how can they find out where to go?
Sure. If you don't have internet access, you can give a call to the library. You can call us at 630-2665. That's 630-BOOK. And somebody there has the list of all the sites and can tell you which libraries they're all at. So that's a great way to find.
630-BOOK, B-O-O-K. Call 630-BOOK to access Summer Break Spot this summer for your child. Free lunch every day if you need it, and snacks, and a lot of other stuff too. And as we continue talking about this, we want your calls about the issue of food insecurity here on the First Coast. It's 549-2937. Diana is in Mandarin. Hi, Diana. Good morning.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just want to know why we have so many children that need food in the first place. Our economy is doing well, and no one really wants a handout. It's great that you have it, but I think the parents really need salaries that can take care of their families. And until we do something about minimum wage, that problem isn't going to be resolved.
Thanks for that, Diana. You know, Michael, it can be hard for people to understand with this strong economy right now and low unemployment that there can be so many people who are struggling and who are food insecure. And so, you know, for millions of Americans, the strong economy is not a reality that they are experiencing.
Exactly. There's a whole issue with the working poor. These are people who work full-time jobs, but are one paycheck away from actually experiencing and going into the cycle of poverty where they actually can't pay their bills. I think your average person in Northeast Florida has, I think, $600 in their bank account. So that's not enough to secure a major catastrophe, whether it be a car that breaks down or you get the flu. So these are most of these families we serve are the working poor who are just having this traumatic event that they're trying to get out of. And this gets them through that process. And it's also part of the cycle of actually summers as well. So there are many people who are employed by different school systems or actually other organizations who don't work this summer. So now they don't have actual summer income. We actually do that at our food bank. We actually register people for SNAP benefits. We're surprised at the influx of actual people who work during the school year but don't now and actually need that help to get through the summer.
Yeah, and as the caller pointed out, Chris, many parents of these kids are working two or even three low-wage jobs just to make ends meet.
Right. It's very challenging there, you know, and we get to see a lot of these kids that, you know, all day that have the family situations like this. And the parents are doing, you know, the best job that they possibly can. They're putting as much together that they can. But, you know, as Michael was saying, it's just there is just that gap. There's just that inability to just make that last little end meet. And it might be a very difficult choice for a parent. And that's why, you know, we are so lucky to see these kids at the library, and the librarians get to know them, and you know, we can really get them involved in this program and make sure that they have all the nutrition for their bodies and their minds.
You know, this is going to be an issue in the presidential campaign. You're going to hear some of the candidates talking about, for example, I listened to a little bit of this on NPR's Morning Edition this morning, talking about one of the biggest employers in this country, Walmart, who you know, employs thousands and thousands of people across the country who are on food stamps. These are working people, but they don't make enough to eat. They have to go get food stamps to eat, even though they're working. What about that?
Yeah,
it's a general issue. Even our food bank has to address it. So we're a nonprofit, and we actually, you know, we're in Northeast Florida, so we try to make sure we give our employees everything they need so they don't have to be food insecure as well. Because that threshold is not low. We actually make sure all our employees have benefits. But it's one of those things that we have done in our own space to make sure of it, because we see it everywhere. We see it in our retail partners. We see it in the community. We see it in the food deserts. The other thing that's important to note is during this time of summer, these kids and these children, these families, they live in food deserts. So most of them who have no transportation are going to get their food from their local bodega or convenience store, which has no healthy food, and it also costs 2 to 7 times more. So they're not even getting as much food as they need, and none of it has any nutritious value. And so we're seeing that kind of continue, and there's no other jobs in those areas. So it's a vicious cycle that has so many variables that it really is going to take everyone together to help find the solution. I know I could help with basic needs, but there are so many things beyond basic needs to help solve this problem.
It's 549-2937. Hunger issues in this summer really spike for millions of Florida families because school is out. We want your calls. Lauren is in the Regency area. Lauren, good morning.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
I am actually a children's librarian at the Regency Branch Library, and I just wanted to say that we absolutely adore having the food program there. It's so much fun to see all the kids. We have tons of them coming in. I think in the past 2 days since we started, each day we've had about 25 kids. And it's not just that it's them getting food. It's also like a community time. The kids get to hang out and get to know each other. They come in and they do the programs and they get to know us and we get to help them read. And it's just a lot of fun. I really love that we have this program.
Thanks, Lauren. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so glad that Lauren called in. It's so great one of our librarians called in. It's wonderful that they do get to see the kids, and they get so engaged and the kids get so happy and they have such a great time.
Lori is in Mandarin. Hey, Lori, how are you this morning?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
All right. Thanks. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
I have more of a comment that I find it amazing with the number of churches in Jacksonville that we even have these problems, because, you know, first and foremost is I believe all of this, including the hunger, is by design. I mean, somebody was mentioning Walmart and how they are not even earning enough of a salary to buy food for themselves. And all of this is by design. Wages have been going down for 20 years. Benefits are doing the same. But the highest paid people, their salaries have been quadrupling. So this is not an accident. This is, this is the way the tax code and everything else is designed to work. So what I want to know is, all that being obvious, why aren't the churches stepping up Why is there a hunger program? I've just passed.
Well, you know what? Hey, Lori, I take all your points, but let me just say that there are a number of churches that work on this issue.
I know there are a number, but my point is that there are thousands and thousands of churches in Jacksonville, and I do not understand for the life of me. You know, they're in building on additions. They're building science centers. They're building up, you know, they're growing into these huge monopolies of nonprofits, and yet they get huge tax deductions for everything they do, and I believe they are accountable and responsible for all of the hunger issues, and that means white people and black people and everyone else.
All right, Lori, yeah. Lori, thanks for the call. Thank you, Lori. Okay, so she made a couple of points, Michael, one being the faith community's role in this. And then the second point she made has to do with the deeper issues we're talking about, which are poverty and income inequality in this country. Let's start with the churches.
So for the churches and faith-based organizations in general, we have about 160 community partners that help distribute food, and a majority of them are faith-based. So they are deeply engaged. They are deeply engaged in their own feeding ministry or engaged in helping the homeless and the poor. So I do see that. I also see, to be honest about the faith-based community, often these are very, in general, poor churches as well. So they are poor people really with their heart helping other poor people. So there is an opportunity for that area to grow significantly. But I guess that would start at the church level. But there is there is a lot of engagement from our network of hunger relief.
Right. And then, Chris, what about the other half of her comments?
Yeah. So as far as what she was saying about, why are there such challenges with getting all this food out to everybody? We actually talked with Kids Hope Alliance about getting this into the libraries every year. And we do get people that ask, why isn't it at my library? Why isn't it in this area and that area? And the fact of the matter is there's just not enough volunteers to go around. So, they are making the best decisions they can and getting it out into the community as best they can.
Let's go to Jordan in Arlington. Hey, Jordan, thanks for holding. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, perfect. Thank you. I've been a long-time listener. This is my first time calling in.
Great.
I just want to make the comment that I've been in the kitchen industry myself now for 9 years, and I work one of the higher-end positions in the kitchen, and luckily I'm blessed to make what I make. I make $8 above minimum wage, but that's only $15 an hour. And the summer season, the slower season, I work about 35 to 40 hours there, and I work another part-time job that's about 25 hours. And I work both of these, and I'm barely able to make ends meet with insurance, car notes, with rent, with all the bills. Now I have a one-year-old daughter. Everything she needs is taken care of. But with these summer programs going on, like, it's perfect to know that I have the ability to be able to have that choice. She's not old enough to be in school yet, and I don't struggle to be able to feed her. But to be able to know that she's going to have a steady meal coming in and that I could be able to use that money towards furthering her to be able to have money for food for her tomorrow in case something happens instead of putting in the day, that's perfect. I guess my main question is, though, is unfortunately a stigma. With the really church topic, I was raised in the church, and we were always taught not to accept handouts unless you're part of that community. The church is a family-based, community-based organization. If you're not part of that community, then you really shouldn't have any place, you know, taking handouts or charity for them.
Okay, well, you know what, Jordan, I so appreciate you sharing your family situation and all of those comments. So thank you for that, because Jordan's story is one that we see all over town. You know, guys, here's a tweet coming into the show from Susie. Please dispel the idea that these children have parents who don't work. I volunteer at a food bank in Springfield. Several weeks ago, a woman wearing scrubs with the name of the office of one of my doctor's offices came through getting food. So it's so important, I think, for people to understand that the working poor families in this community, these are parents who work full time and work very hard. And as Jordan pointed out, they make anywhere from $8 to $15 an hour and maybe take a second job. And that's not enough money to live on and feed their children. It's just not enough money.
And I think if I could throw something on that is, one, I run a lot of these pantries and we serve a lot of clients, and they are a majority of them working full-time jobs. And oftentimes I will talk to them and ask them, and they'll be like, oh, I needed this months ago. And I always ask them, why? Why didn't you come months ago? And they almost always say, I didn't want to take it from someone who needed it more. And I always find that a very human comment. And there's more than enough food that we could bring into this community. It is the volunteers. It is the distribution. It is the amount of cost it gets food out there. And that's where, like, the community needs to come together with that. But it is very, there's a lot of dignity we try to have when we give food to those who need it. And most people who actually go to the pantry, they go three times in their life. They go three times just to get through an emergency situation. They're not abusing the system. They're just hitting hard times trying to get through it.
Here's a tweet from Crystalis. This is a great program, but at what point do we put similar efforts into addressing the root of the issue, poverty? Systemic policies need to change. And jammed lines as we talk about this issue, which affects so many people around the First Coast. Margaret is on the north side. Margaret, you're on the air. Go ahead. Good morning.
Good morning. You're talking about Walmart. Believe me, it's not one of my favorite places to shop. But the state is no better. They do not pay you. They're very skinny on their raises. And if you make $12 an hour, you're making good money with the state. No telling when you'll get another raise. So just don't put Walmart in there. Put some of these other places, too. We all have to try to struggle to make an ends meet.
Do you work for the state, Margaret?
I did for 17 years.
Are you retired now?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
But my daughter works for them, and I know she don't make but $12 an hour, and it took her a while to get there. And you got to pay insurance and taxes and everything else out of that, just like everybody else does.
Thanks for that call, Margaret. Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah, I mean, this is an issue of low-wage work.
Right. Yeah, so there is. There's a lot of low-wage work out there. It's tough. One thing that we do get to see that's really nice is at the library, we do have adult education programs, and we see people that are working really hard to get to some of the next programs. So whether we get a GED or you get your high school diploma, we've seen people come through that are really trying to, make that extra effort, and we're lucky to be able to give them that opportunity.
Chris in St. Augustine. Chris, good morning. What are your thoughts?
Hi, my name is Chris, and I was an administrator for the SNAP program for almost 30 years. And what happens is frequently there's these huge penalties with regards to people who go to work with regard to the SNAP program. For example, it was brought up about 10-month employees. The budgeting with regards to 10-month employees penalizes the people during the summer months. Their income is actually averaged over the summer months. So they're not getting any income, and it's being held against them. The other thing is frequently that income is often penalized against them, and their benefits drop drastically. And frequently it's months after the income is received. So these type of programs are a lifeline that is so desperately needed because of the ever-changing regulations. And within the last couple of years, the regulations have changed sometimes on a monthly basis. It's become, the federal programs have become so unreliable that, you know, it's become necessary for the churches and the pantries just to have to pick up the slack, which is, it's just sad.
Thanks for that, Chris. Michael, do you agree with that?
I do, and I think I was just thinking about the other things that affect hunger as well. We have several programs. I was thinking of the caller earlier with the family. We actually have initiated a diaper program for this summer. So we're giving diapers to the churches. So we could actually augment that, because that's also something SNAP doesn't support. SNAP does not support all of the other non-foods that you actually need. So if you get those benefits, you still need detergent, you still need toilet paper, you still need a number of other items that are very costly.
Jenny, let's go to Shonda in downtown Jacksonville. Shonda, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thank you. This is my first time calling in. My name is Shonda Works. I am the director of Bibish, Inc. I have a very small food pantry in North Central Florida, in White Springs. And I had to interject some things I wanted to say about this food pantry industry. First of all, one of my concerns with this, they seem to be more capitalizing now on the food that's donated to these food banks. I've struggled with getting a food bank that would allow us a membership, that would allow us a membership to get food to serve people, because they wanted copies of our bank statements. They wanted information that just wasn't appropriate for us to serve people. Now, we're a very small nonprofit organization, and our goal is just to meet the needs of people. The other point I wanted to make out as well is there's a bigger issue, too, with this food bank or this food shortage industry or food insecurity industry. There's another group that we're really not talking much about, or maybe you might have talked about it, and that's the seniors. We have senior citizens as well who are on a fixed income, who require special diet. They have a special diet. Food banks don't have these items that the seniors need to help sustain their health. And this is really sad. I go through one of the organizations that don't require much paperwork, but sometimes some of the food that comes through is outdated, is rotted. You know, and sometimes it's stuff that people can't use. This is a really, really big problem. But my biggest problem is the food banks with these guidelines and moving, you know, the guidelines of where you can come and get food for people
to
help them out. If you're not in this area, you can't work. You can't use our bank. You have to go to that area. It's really, really sad.
Okay, Shonda. And there's Shonda working in the middle of all of this in downtown Jacksonville. So thanks for all of that, Shonda. So bureaucracy can get in the way of moving food to people who need it the most, Michael. And also, as we talk about children, the other really vulnerable population out there, as she pointed out, is senior citizens.
Yeah. So I'll address it on two fronts. I think she was talking about another area, too. It sounds like Central Florida. And so each food bank's different. One thing, as we're going through this, is I do have an appeal to any organization out there that wants to actually help distribute food. We bring on new agencies every quarter. And we want to bring on more to help distribute that food. All you really need is a 501(c) and no bank statements required. If you are actually interested, you can go to the website, you know, feedingnefl.org. Now, for the seniors, yes, it's actually a big issue. That's actually a year-round issue, right? So seniors have, over the years, been reduced with their SNAP benefits. They are experiencing more and more social isolation. Their incomes are not actually increasing in any way, shape, or form as things go up. So we actually have a nutrition pack program that we actually provide healthy, in-date, good products to seniors across a number of homes, as well as Farm Fresh. We actually partnered with LSS recently and fed an entire senior home with a bag of produce, a bag of meat, and a bag of dry goods, providing enough food for about a month for those seniors. And we wanted to see what that experience was like for them. The feedback we've been given is, if you care about us, people are still interested in us, and how do we get more engaged and how do we keep this going? So I think seniors is something that need to be addressed all year.
I mean, Chris, this program at the library is for kids, but we want to make that clear. But we're also trying to get the word out about all of the help that's available for everyone.
Right. So, yeah, we do have opportunities for kids. This program is actually available to those people who are mentally or physically disabled and are already getting lunches during the school year. But yeah, we have tons of services and we love to see seniors and great things for them at the library.
Let's take one last call. It's Jenny in East Arlington. Jenny, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. I really just had a simple question, and then I've been listening, and this is such a complex problem. It's overwhelming, and I think people are easily overwhelmed by things like this and turn away. So my initial first simple question is, how do we help?
Sure.
How can I volunteer?
How can people help? Yeah.
I work 6 days a week. You know, I'm not making enough money to cover my bills, but we have to pitch in and do what we can for other people. You were just talking about the different people that have needs for this. I mean, I have friends who are my contemporaries. They don't have children, but they are still going hungry. They don't feel comfortable approaching services that they know are intended for families. How can we help?
Yeah.
I know that my time is limited because I work until 6 or 7 at night. What can we do? Is there a place to go where we can combine efforts?
Thanks, Jenny. Yeah. Other folks are waiting on hold to ask that same question, which I think speaks to the giving spirit of so many in this community. Let's begin with you, Michael. How can people support Feeding Northeast Florida?
So financial donations are always welcome because that's what's needed to get food to where it goes. With our capabilities, a dollar can get 6 meals out very easily. However, I understand that's not always the case. For those who actually want to volunteer, we have volunteers in our warehouse 5 days a week, sorting, inspecting, making sure all the food that goes to those who need are in the most highest quality. Other things that can be done if you're working during those times that volunteer shifts happen and you have limited funds is to do a food drive that you could reach out to your community and collect food. Just the other day, I had a 9-year-old and her mom come in and they did a peanut butter drive. So she brought in over 200 pounds of peanut butter that she collected through her neighbors and asking. So there are so many ways to actually help. And I actually asked her, I can't remember her name. I apologize for that. I was like, so who do you want this to go to? Do you want it to go to children? Do you want it to go to a county, rural? She's like, seniors. That's why it came up. And I was like, I actually go down to Campus Towers. This will all go there. So there's a number of ways to actually.
Yeah. And begin by just going to their website, Jenny and everyone else, Feeding Northeast Florida, which is feedingnefl.org. If you click on that, there are all kinds of ways you can help. Beginning, of course, if you can afford it with a monetary donation, but you can also volunteer. And Chris Bovin, the library, which is now up and running with summer break spot for kids, they can always use some help too.
Yes, we can absolutely use help. So if you are interested in volunteering, you can go to our website, jackspubliclibrary.org, and find out how to volunteer. But the other thing that you can do, share this information with all your friends, with all your family, with everybody else. Share this information out. That's the most important thing and the most valuable thing that you can do for anybody. You never know who might be in a situation that may be helped by this. So that's what I would recommend. Just please keep sharing this.
And call 630-BOOK to enroll your child in the free summer lunch program. Chris Bovin with the library, Michael Neff, Feeding Northeast Florida. Thanks for sharing this very hot topic on the air today.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, a preview of the new Phase 8 production debuting this month at our own WJCT studios. But up next, a conversation with the author of Abandoned Jacksonville. We'll be right back.
Abel Bean Law, with over 100 combined years of experience in solving problems with practical legal strategies, Abel Bean Law is committed to your success by providing intelligent, efficient advocacy and legal counsel. Learn more at abelbeanlaw.com.
We didn't think it was a big deal for me to be a pregnant man. In Portland, like maybe if you see a pregnant man at Starbucks, that's not the weirdest thing you've seen that day.
Join us for more true stories told live. This week, a pregnant man, a wedding, a divorce, and something called the Nacho Challenge. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a fascinating look at some of the forgotten parts of this region. David Bulett of the popular blog Abandoned Florida has just published a new book shining the spotlight on our area. It's called Abandoned Jacksonville, Ruins of the First Coast. He's on the line now with a look inside. David, good to have you on the show. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Really good. And your blog, Abandoned Florida, is really popular. I encourage everyone to take a look at it. So what prompted you to turn your attention to Jacksonville and some of our forgotten places?
Well, I've been exploring Florida for about 10 years now, and Jacksonville just has the highest concentration of abandoned buildings. And I would say that's because the government up there, well, they just don't really care about the history or the architecture or, you know, the buildings that are already there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that is a real issue, particularly in the La Villa neighborhood and some other places around town. And so in writing this book, you touch on many locations around the city. Tell us about some of them.
Well, there's the Mullen-Cow Funeral Home, and that one is probably not going to be standing up for long. It's actually for sale right now, but it's, in my opinion, too far gone to be repaired. There's the roof is collapsed, the basement is flooded, the interior has a lot of mold damage. There was recently a fire in there, and it's one of those buildings that has a lot of history dating back to the 1800s and is actually the oldest running business in Jacksonville and Jacksonville's first funeral home. But a lot of that history is forgotten and just not known because nobody really talks about it.
Some other places you visit are the 310 West Church Street apartments that used to be a beautiful building, but it's got a bit of a dark past. You educate us about its ties to the cocaine epidemic, correct?
Correct. That's one of those buildings that was actually directly affected by the demolition of the La Villa neighborhood because the government over there decided that best course was to demolish an entire neighborhood without thinking where all these people are going to go, and they decided to just migrate to the nearest buildings, and the 310 apartments was one of those buildings, and it just suffered from prostitution, drug addiction, you name it, you know?
Yeah. The Annie Lytle School is another one. That's a school building that's been closed for 50-plus years. People driving by it on a highway overpass can see it, and there are urban legends around that building, you know, ghost stories. And that's something that you touch on when a site is abandoned, a lore and a creepiness, you know, starts to develop around it. Is that a running theme in your work?
It's not a run. What I would like to do is not touch on those too much. I would like to tell people that these places aren't for ghosts or the paranormal or people like that. I try to discredit those because, one, I don't believe in it, and two, it gives that building a bad name for the neighborhood it's in and the people looking at it, you know? They don't want to restore the local haunted house, for example. And for public school number 4, for example, there's stories about a janitor that killed people or the boiler exploding. But yeah, none of that happened. And what I try to touch on is just its history and wanting to reuse, restore it, or do something with it. Even if it's to gut the entire inside and just keep the facade, that would be better than just leveling the entire building.
I understand. Yeah, with your blog and with this book, you're making a powerful argument for changing the culture of demolition and abandonment, which, as you said, is unfortunately really prevalent in this city. Not only do we have a high number of abandoned places, this city has also been demolishing a lot of structures controversially in recent months and has plans to demolish a downtown iconic structure, although one that has fallen on hard times, the Jacksonville Landing. What are your thoughts about the demolition spree in this city?
I mean, my voice, I feel, means nothing because a lot of people have spoken about it throughout the years. And from the demolition of the La Villa neighborhood to now Jacksonville Landing, you look at where La Villa neighborhood used to be, it's just all surface parking now. And now they're leveling Jacksonville Landing to replace it with nothing. It's stuff like that that angers me, and I'm sure angers a lot of residents in Jacksonville. I'm not even, I don't even live or even from Jacksonville, and it angers me that the city has no clear vision for what the city is about or what it's going to be, you know? There's surface parking on one end and then green space on another, and then they want to build, trying to restore the banks downtown to bring hotels and stuff, but this, I have no idea what their vision is, and I think that there is no vision.
You have a very clear vision, though, not only in this book, but also on your website, which is abandonedfl.com. Your photography has been featured around the world, and you have other published books. And so you travel the state looking at these places. When do you plan to come back up here to Jacksonville, and how can people meet you? Are you planning any book signings?
Actually, I'm heading up to Jacksonville today. But I will have a book signing on the 15th at the Chamblin Uptown. And that's really the only time that people would actually be able to meet me, because I just like to stay out of the spotlight and just let my work do the talking, you know?
Let your words and your images speak for themselves. Well, as far as I know, Chamblin's is not in any imminent danger of being abandoned, which is good news.
No.
And so I would encourage everyone to come out on the evening of the 15th, right? It's an evening appearance to meet you.
I believe it is at 12
o'clock. Oh, it's a noon appearance. Okay. Come on out on the 15th at noon to meet David Bullitt, author and historian. He runs the popular blog Abandoned Florida, and his new book is called Abandoned Jacksonville, Ruins of the First Coast. So good to have you on the show, David. I encourage everyone to pick up a copy and also look at your website, because it covers the gamut in Florida, but there are quite a few sites in Jacksonville that people can click on and learn about on your website. It's abandonedfl.com. David, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And up next, what happens after you get the HIV diagnosis? Author and artist Ebony Payne English puts those emotions into words, and it's in a new production debuting this month at WJCT. After the break, we'll tell you about the debut of On Purpose. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Back in a moment.
Abel Bean Law. With over 100 combined years of experience in solving problems with practical legal strategies, Abel Bean Law is committed to your success by providing intelligent, efficient advocacy and legal counsel. Learn more at abelbeanlaw.com.
If you don't know his name, you know his work. Join WJCT on June 18th for an evening with Frontline's Michael Kirk, an award-winning documentarian. For tickets and more info, visit wjct.org/events.
On the next Fresh Air.
How do you forgive someone who hits your husband with their car and then drives away, leaving him to bleed to death on the side of the road? How do you forgive that?
We talk with Christina Applegate, who stars as the grieving widow on the Netflix series Dead to Me. She played the daughter in Married with Children and co-starred in Anchorman. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Thank you. Schools and offices across the country run active shooter drills to help people prepare for a real emergency, but they can have unintended consequences.
When the Parkland shooting happened, a lot of the teachers weren't sure whether this was a drill, which they've been having unannounced, or a real event.
I'm Audie Cornish, weighing the value of realistic shooting drills this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Miscarriages are extremely common. Every year, millions of American women experience this type of pregnancy loss. But miscarriages are often misunderstood. That's having a bigger impact now that more states are passing anti-abortion laws. Myths and miscarriages. Next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it is an exploration of love, life, and poetry. In the new production, On Purpose, Duval spoken word artist Ebony Payne English shares the aftermath of her diagnosis of HIV. This production is directed by Jamario Stills of Phase 8 Theater Company, and it debuts here at WJCT this month. Jamario, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you on the show.
Always good to be here.
Okay, so On Purpose is debuting Friday, June 14th, next Friday, here at WJCT. And this stars a local leading light of the arts and culture community in town, Ebony Payne English. What's the show all about?
Yeah, this we are sort of remounting of the show that we did last year. It was a bit of our opening presentation to share with the world as to what we're about. This project is a call to action in a lot of ways. It's discussing a global epidemic that we are encasing with a beautiful one-woman show where she depicts nine different women who are contracted with the HIV/AIDS virus, and it is backdropped by a digital set. So we'll have projections and all types of interesting lighting to accentuate the performance.
So we hear the stories of nine different women who are dealing with the diagnosis of HIV.
Yeah.
Are these real, true stories?
These are stories that are inspired by women who she's come in contact with. And so what she did was artfully wind these stories into a narrative whereby she is literally changing in and out of different characters to share this story of various perspectives. And that's the beauty of the story, is that it comes from it from all different angles. There's not one prototype as to who is contracted with this. It's all walks of life, and she does a beautiful job.
She plays all the parts.
She plays all the parts.
This is such an important issue for Duval because we have an HIV epidemic in Duval County.
Sure
we have
do.
Some of the highest rates of HIV and AIDS in America.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was definitely part of the conversation when we initially discussed it. This is like, this extends beyond the idea of merely just doing art. We're trying to have a conversation, and we're trying to give a perspective that allows people to have a lot more empathy about those who are afflicted by it.
And also, we've been so pleased over the years, it's been a couple of years now, that Phase 8 Theater Company has been staging productions in our WJCT studios.
Yeah.
And so it's exciting to have this new one rerunning,
right.
Friday, June 14th at 8 o'clock. People can get their tickets now at phase8.org for On Purpose. At the same time, you have some personal news to share.
Want to
tell us about it?
Well, this would be my last hurrah, as it were, for producing shows locally as I begin the process of transitioning to Brown University, where I'll be receiving my Master's of Fine Arts degree in directing. And so
fancy.
I'm just doing the best I can, Melissa.
You're doing pretty good. So you're leaving at the end of the summer to go up to Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Will Phase 8 Theater Company continue with others, or is it going? Is this a last hurrah?
Oh no, we are just beginning. We're going to put some awesome, intelligent theater makers in place to continue to run the machine. And I'm still very much so going to be hands on.
Even from Rhode Island. And, you know, you've made a big contribution to the theater scene. How do you see that whole world here in Northeast Florida developing?
Expanding. The audiences are becoming much more engaged, and the theaters are doing a much more beautiful job at producing shows, elevating the caliber of art. We're just getting started with theater here in Jacksonville.
That's exciting. And, you know, I have to say, too, it's been exciting to add this to what we do in the building, because we do a number of events at our in our main studio, all kinds of stuff, television productions, live events, plays like yours, you name it. We do it in that studio. And so it adds a lot of energy to the building to have all of these creatives coming through. You know,
and I would be remiss if I didn't thank WJCT, the leadership, the staff, the team, everyone who has been involved with Phase 8. You all have done a tremendous job of supporting us, and my hat's off to you.
Well, thank you, and good luck at Brown University.
Thank you so much.
So fancy now. You'll have to not forget all about us.
Oh, no. Duval is with me everywhere I go.
And go to phase8.org and get your tickets now for On Purpose by Ebony Payne English. It is next Friday night. Friday and Saturday night at 8 o'clock at WJCT Studios. Jamario,
yeah.
Good luck. We'll miss you.
Miss you too.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And we always want your feedback about the program. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, we speak with leaders of the city's Cure Violence program. That's coming up tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. Have a great day, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.